Wow, it's good to be back with you on a Wednesday night here. It's been a few mini moons since I've been with you. I guess it was November 2nd. I was looking back today, the last time I preached on a Wednesday night, and so almost a month away. So good to be back with you. Pastor Mark preached on the 9th, and then we had the celebration service, and then last week taking off for Thanksgiving. And so we're glad to come back with you one more time here in 2016 on Wednesday night as we finish up our point service season. We take December off to give folks room for family and for classes to get together and Christmas parties, just all that sort of stuff. And so we look forward to one last time together, and tonight we're going to wrap up our series. So go with me to Acts chapter 17 is where we want to go tonight. Acts 17. So on Monday night, there was a lot of darkness, wasn't there, around Bowling Green. More than 14,000 homes lost power here in Warren County. Wind took out, I've been watching the construction driving back and forth on I-65 there. On Cumberland Trace alone, 14 poles knocked down there. They were snapped just like a twig. And like they said, like gusts up to 70 miles per hour came through there, straight line winds. It was interesting. I have some friends that live in Oakland. And just Thanksgiving, they took this beautiful picture of their family in front of this nice red barn, like 20 of them. And then they showed a picture the other day, and they had that picture below. And then above was the picture of the barn completely demolished on the ground. So there was just a bad storm that came through. Thousands of folks were without power. How many of you guys lost power? Yeah. So when the electricity and the lights, they suddenly went out, folks had to grope about in the darkness to try to find some light. Now, some groped for their cell phones. You didn't have to look far for that because most of us keep that close by pretty easily. I don't even really own a flashlight anymore because, I mean, the phone does everything, doesn't it? You don't need a watch. You don't need a flashlight anymore. It just does it all. You don't need a calendar. None of that stuff. It does everything. So maybe you just grabbed your flashlight on your phone. So others probably groped about in the darkness to find that junk drawer where that flashlight is kept. And once you actually found it, maybe you stubbed your toe on the way or whatever. Once you found it, it's likely that you found out the batteries that were in the flashlight were flat, and so didn't even work, and so then you had to grope about in the dark trying to find batteries. And maybe you groped about for candles, matches, or maybe coal oil lamps. That's what we always used to pull out, you know, when the lights would go out in our neck of the woods. And I don't know, that was always kind of neat. You know, Dad would light those, and you'd have them there, and it was just a neat glow about the room. But folks typically like to shed some light on dark situations because we're not fans of the dark. Now, let me ask you a serious question, but it's a very obvious answer. Do you think that those folks who were in the dark on Monday night knew that they were in the dark? Yes. Everybody say yes. They knew it. Most of them, surely they did. Most of them did, unless they were blind or out of their minds. Physical darkness is easy to perceive, isn't it? Right? I mean, our eyes quickly tell us that there is no light here. It's all dark. It was readily apparent to them. But as we talked about on Sunday morning, there are billions of people on the planet. Billions, literally billions upon billions of people on planet Earth who are in spiritual darkness and don't know it. They are oblivious to the fact that they are in spiritual darkness. They're deceived into thinking that their darkness is light. And if you'll remember from just a few Sundays before this past Sunday, we read what Jesus said in Matthew 6:23, Jesus said, "But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness?" So we come to our final message in the Ignite series, from Bowling Green to the ends of the earth. We come to what was supposed to be the most enlightened place on the planet, the Areopagus in Athens, Greece. Now, when you think about ancient civilizations, the Greeks, they stand at the top for their intellectual prowess, for their philosophical understandings. I mean, they gave us Socrates and all these famous philosophers that nobody reads, but we all talk about like we've read them, okay? Who wants to read those dudes, okay? Unless we have to. And even then, we go get the Cliff Notes because we don't even want to read them then, okay? But this place here, the Areopagus, literally translated in English as Mars Hill. I didn't know that until today. That's pretty cool. Didn't know that. Mars Hill or Eris Hill. Eris was the Greek god of war. The god of war for the Romans was Mars, okay? So Eris Hill or Mars Hill is what we would translate into English, the Areopagus. But on the southeast summit of this hill, the leaders of Athens would come and gather together. They would meet, they would hold court, they would counsel together about whatever's going on in the city. Now, by the time that Paul reached Athens here, the court didn't really have the judicial power it once had. I mean, it used to be able to put people to death, right? It was like a judicial court. You'd come and you'd try your case and they would make a judgment. But at this point, it was still a place, though, where learned people would come, they would debate philosophy, they would talk about religion, all those things on this big rock out there high up in the air. People, would stay for hours. Now, Paul was informally here, and we're about to see in the text, he's informally brought before the Areopagus here to give an account for what he had been teaching. And although the quote-unquote enlightened ones gathered to hear what Paul had to say, the Areopagus, as a microcosm of the greater city of Athens around it, was a place of great darkness. Therefore, it stands as a great example for the necessity of the mission that Jesus has given us. That's the title of tonight's message: The Necessity of the Mission. All right, our text tonight is Acts 17. We're going to look at verse 16 through 34. So we'll read it bit by bit. We're not going to read it in one big chunk. We're going to take it bit by bit as we sort of walk through it here tonight. As we turn to it, it's going to teach us a few things. It's going to help us to understand a few things about people, about us, all right? So the first thing it helps you and me to understand is that people naturally worship. Now, this isn't, right, anything that's news to anybody, okay? I mean, you've seen this all your life. People are religious all over the world, regardless of the century you're talking about, regardless of the continent they're on, regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of their culture. Mankind everywhere worships. Now, the intellectual fools in the universities or wherever you want to talk about who deny the existence of God, I mean, they want to tell you and me that the preponderance of worshiping, people worshiping all over the earth, is simply a product of evolutionary processes. It's something that man has created, sort of we brought about to simply survive better than the person down the road who doesn't believe in God. They would say it's sort of a natural selection processes in evolution that's brought about this religiosity in mankind. But let's say right up front, that's what they want to believe, right? That's what they want to believe. They're choosing to believe it. The truth is, worshiping is in our nature, right? It's how we've been designed. Think about this, like birds fly, like lions roar, humans worship. Excuse me. So it's in the very fabric of our human soul to worship something. And the people of Athens, they were no different. I mean, they're simply being humans. They were doing what humans do. Now, Paul here in Athens, he had some time on his hands. We find out just a few verses before we get into 16 that Paul was hanging out with Silas and Timothy, and he had went on ahead of them. Silas and Timothy were wrapping up some things, and they were supposed to come and get with Paul. And so he had a little time to pass there in Athens, a little sightseeing, so to speak. And religion, everywhere he looked, was around him. It was everywhere. So let's go to Acts 17, verse 16. Let's read that together. Someone read it for us, actually. Thank you, Wendy. Acts 17, 16. Somebody read that real loud for us.
Now, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols.
Man, they were everywhere. Everywhere. Now, when you think about the Greek culture here, which although it's under Roman rule at this point, right, it's still the Greek culture, right? You can take the, you can't take the Greek out of the Greeks, all right? And so when you think about the Greeks, they worshiped like 12 different gods officially on Mount Olympus that they believed ruled over all the people. You had Aphrodite, you had Apollo, Eris, Artemis, Athena, Hermes, Hephaestus, Hades, Poseidon, Zeus. Did I say that wrong? Oh, okay. But there were others. I mean, you know, there were always some god, and there were demigods and all these other things sort of mixed in there. And so it was just a big mess. But then you take the Roman culture that was sort of interlapped with this. They officially worshipped many gods, but the main that they worshipped were nine main gods. There was Jupiter. It's like naming the planets here, okay? Jupiter, Neptune, Juno, Mars, Venus, Bellona, Minerva, Janus, Vesta. And then if you remember, the emperor, he was a god too, right? They counted him as a god. And so Athens, with its Greek heritage and its Roman governance, I mean, it was a mixed bag of polytheistic religion. But I want to say, they were doing simply what humanity does. They were worshiping something. They were worshiping. And it troubled Paul, didn't it? You remember what it says here? Look here, back here at verse 16. Paul was waiting for him. His spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. It sickened Paul. Yeah, he was killing a little time, but he wasn't just experiencing this. He wasn't just taking it in as a tourist. Now think about this for just a moment. A lot of the things that you and I go to see are instruments of false religion around the world. Name some of the places you've been that are instruments of false religion around the world that people go and they take pictures of and they say, wow, look at that. That's beautiful architecture and all that stuff. What are some places? Yeah, the pyramids. Yeah, right. These are graves for the pharaohs that they believe to be gods. Where else? Yeah. The ruins of Athens you're talking about, right? Yeah, you go there. I mean, the Olympics were there a few years back, and undoubtedly, I don't know, millions of people probably went through there, and they said, "Man, look at these pillars, and look at these ruins, and all this stuff." I mean, just down the road in Nashville. Have y'all been to the Parthenon? Right? That's the Greek goddess, or is that Athena there? Yeah, Athena? I mean, when you walk in there, I mean, you're literally walking in a pretend Greek temple with a deity 20 or 30 feet tall. Right there, a big idol right there. Anywhere else you can think of? You know, I think about, like, you know, some of my last association where we lived in Tennessee, the Salem Association. You know, they took a mission trip down, where was it? It was somewhere in Central America. I can't think of the name of it right now. But they were down in Central America, and these ziggurats were everywhere, right? These big, you know, these kind of like pyramids, but big steps up to the top, and they're climbing. Everybody's climbing around on them, taking pictures, going to the top. I mean, just yeah, all those guys. Yeah, made all sorts of stuff down there, you know. But remember, I mean, these are religious sites. Just keep that in mind next time. You know, I mean, for me, for instance, you know, when I traveled to China in 2014. I mean, you're going to in all these Buddhist temples, and you're thinking, man, this is beautiful in one sense. But then it hits you. People come here every day groping about in the darkness, and they are worshiping the devil. I mean, let's just be honest. They don't know it's the devil, but they're worshiping the devil. I remember standing in one of the temples in the Nara province there on the island we were on, and we kept hearing this call going out, and the type of mission trip it is, you literally just sort of walk and find what you can find, and you talk to whom you can talk to. And so we heard this sound, and we saw this gate and a road, and people kind of come in. We was like, well, let's just go see what it is. One time that kind of backfired on us. We accidentally walked into this commercial fishing plant and sort of village, and people were like, why are you guys here? You're not supposed to be here. But this time we walked in, and we came to this. I mean, it was a beautifully built building with all sorts of neat architecture and colors and all this stuff. But inside was supposed to be sort of the patron deity of the agricultural fields all out there. And they would play this thing over the loudspeaker that was supposed to speak to the spirits to give them good crops. It's just really amazing to think about. And when that hits you, what it's actually being used for, you can't help but get sick, right? It can't help but trouble you, as it says here. So that's exactly what was happening here. Now, Paul, he decided not to stand idly by. He began to engage folks. Look at verse 17 through 21. Somebody read that for us here. Acts 17, verse 17 through 21. Whoever, jump in there.
So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know therefore what these things mean." And now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new.
Well, that seems like the spirit of our age, doesn't it? So here he's engaging with the Jews. He's trying to convert them to Christ. He's also engaging with the Epicureans, with the Stoics. When you take the Epicureans and the Stoics and you combine them with the Cynics, these are, you know, we use the word Stoic and Cynic all the time, but these are actually philosophical groups in contemporary Athens that Paul's here, in here. So with the Epicureans and the Stoics and the Cynics, that represented all the schools of thought, the primary popular schools of thought that were going around Athens in those days. Now the Epicureans, it was central to them, man, get as much pleasure as you can. Avoid pain at all costs, right? They were the hedonists of the day. Now the Stoics, they didn't want any emotion, any feeling, right? That's where we get that, he's such a Stoic. That means he doesn't show emotion, right? They wanted to avoid pain. They wanted to avoid pleasure, and they wanted to show when they were not in pain. Kind of a boring life, it seems to me, but that's what they were all about. They were the ascetics of the day, and so Paul begins to engage them. He was surrounded by people worshiping everywhere. Everywhere. So they brought him to the Areopagus, the official place to talk about religion and philosophy, and there were folks hanging out, and their delight was to simply hear something new. Something new, you know, sort of like a dance. Do a dance for us and tell us something new. You know, Bowling Green, Scottsville, but more Bowling Green than Scottsville, is a very religious city, isn't it? Very religious. Now, I don't know if it's the Athens of the day, maybe not to that extent, but it's still a very religious city. Let's think here for just a moment. How many different religions do you think you can name here in Bowling Green? Now, I'm not talking about denominations. We'll count the Presbyterians and the Baptists, both as Christian, all right, all that, and the other Christian denominations all together, okay? But other religions, well, which ones could you name?
Scientology,
would you say?
Islam.
Greek Orthodox. Maybe be counted as Christian, potentially. Jehovah's Witness.
Jewish.
Mormon.
Buddhist.
Mm-hmm. Unitarian. Yeah, Unitarian Universalist. Yeah. There's probably some we're not even thinking of, right? What's that? Yeah, we'd consider Lutheran in with the Christians. We let them sit at the table with us. You know, so you can think about all these different religions here of the day, okay? All these different religions of the day. Now, the Lutherans might bring a beer to the table, but it'd be okay. But there are all sorts of different religions here in Bowling Green, all right? Now, just think about this for a moment. Now, when you think about some of the buildings, I mean, particularly you mentioned Islam. I mean, again, you know, the two mosques here in Bowling Green, religious sites. They're not tourist attractions by any stretch of the imagination. But think about this for a moment. There is a place just outside of Bowling Green that we go and tourists all the time. But it's a place of false religion. That's right, Shaker Village. The Shakers. Mother Ann Lee believed that she was the second coming of Jesus Christ in female form. All right? And that's where all that came about. And so when you go there, they, of course, downplay, you know, the fact that it was a sort of a cult and a false religion. And we, you know, we sing their songs and buy their brooms and their craft work and all that stuff. So, guys, when you think about it, we're surrounded by people who are worshiping. Everybody in Bowling Green worships something. People naturally worship. And so we're simply going to build tonight on this phrase right here. People naturally worship. People naturally worship. So the next thing the text helps us to understand that people naturally worship. But second, the text demonstrates that sinful people naturally worship wrongly. All right? So people naturally worship, but sinful people naturally worship wrongly. Now, trick question here in a sense. What percentage of the people in the world would you estimate to be sinners? 100%, right? So what does that mean here? If sinful people naturally worship wrongly, that means that every person on the planet naturally, within in and of themselves, left to themselves, would worship wrongly, okay? Sinners, we just don't get it right. We can't. Why? Well, one is we're groping about in the darkness, right? Think about how we opened up here with Monday night. That's what we're doing. We're groping about in the darkness. But more importantly, Romans 1 tells us that our darkened hearts suppress the truth, right? When a little light tries to come in, we snuff it out. We stomp it out. We ignore it. Don't put that in my face. So when you think about all that, we naturally desire false gods, idols, gods of our own making. John Calvin, he said it this way. He said that the fallen human heart is an idol-making factory. I love that, the imagery of that. I mean, I hate the reality of that, but the imagery is so vivid there. Ben Simpson's heart is an idol-making factory. Now, here's the question I want us to chew on for just a moment. Why do you think that we had rather worship a God of our own making than to worship the one true and living God? Why do we prefer false gods over the one true and living God? What do you think?
Convenience
certainly is one of them. What's that?
Apples.
In the beginning. Oh, okay. Gotcha. Forbidden fruit, right? Yeah, we want what we shouldn't have, right? Okay, I got you. Threw me for a loop there for a minute, Shannon. I mean, I like apples too. Why else? Yeah, if we make our own God, then we can sort of set the rules, can't we? That's right. Yeah, we can yell at ourselves. Yeah, we're going to set up. Why else? Yeah, we can control, can't we? Now, you think about all the religions. How many of the religions are simply, they're sort of built on placating that God, right? If to go back to China, for instance, here. I mean, all over the place when you go into these temples, man, they had fruit up there. They had, you know, cigarettes burning. They had all this stuff up there to placate this deity, to manipulate and to control this deity to do what they wanted the deity to do. Any other things you can think of? No real accountability. We get to be God in the end, don't we? So guys, when you think about that, sinful people naturally worship wrongly. We want to make false God because that's what our heart would rather have based upon our sinfulness, okay? But think about this in love. I want you to notice here, in love, Paul points this truth out, that they were worshiping wrongly. Somebody read Acts 17, verse 22 and 23 for us tonight. Somebody read that real loud for us.
Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said,
"Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your object of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship as something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you."
Yeah, you know, in my translation, you know, says that you worship in ignorance. All right. So when you think about this right here, Paul's gracious, okay? He's not trying to get killed at the moment, all right? He basically says, listen, you guys just don't know any better at this point, okay? We're just going to give you a break here. He's being gracious. He's being gracious here. But whatever the reason might be, whether you look at it in that way or you're a little bit harder and say, no, they're wanting this false god. The Athenians were sinners, and just like every other sinner, they were naturally worshiping wrongly. Here's the final thing from this text to think about tonight. So people naturally worship. Sinful people naturally worship wrongly. And to build on that again tonight, finally tonight, we see that since sinful people naturally worship wrongly, it is absolutely necessary for us to witness to the truth of Jesus. Beloved, they will never figure it out on their own. You wouldn't have figured it out on your own. I would have not figured it out on my own. We must step in and be witnesses. That's what our mission is about, and that's why it's absolutely necessary. Ben Simpson would still be groping about in the darkness, trying to find that which I was looking for. And I would have never found God on my own. I would have found a hammer and some wood and some nails. And I'd have built me a god. I would have worshipped wrongly. But Paul here gives us a great example of what our witness ought to contain, all right? So we're going to walk through this here, his message here. Here are four things that your witness, my witness, and again, remember, yes, we live out our witness, but you can't be a witness if you don't speak your witness, okay? So our witness is a proclamation, all right? The first thing that he sort of demonstrates for us here is that our witness should proclaim God's absolute rights over people. This is one of the reasons why we prefer a false god. We don't want a god that owns us. But that's exactly who God is. Look at verse 24 through 27. Acts 17, 24 through 27. Somebody read that loud for us. So here we have an independent God. We have a sovereign God, a God who is there and he's in control and he gives us life and breath and he sets boundaries and all this stuff, what only God can do. We need to let people know that God created them, God sustains them, and God one day will hold them accountable for their life. God is in control. He has rights over people, all right? Now, if that's not true, then there's no reason to preach the gospel because you can slide around God. But every one of us one day will stand before God, all right? Because he made us, he sustains us, he's told us what to do. Second, our witness ought to utilize common culture to help people understand God and the things of God. I think it's interesting what Paul does here. Now, you know, theologians or whatever, they'll call this contextualization. Right? It's taking the truth of God and wrapping it in terms that people are familiar with. I appreciated a moment ago, you know, Mark said that, you know, the there's some redneck here, all right, when we talk about hallelujah. You know, Jesus hung out with rednecks. I mean, they'd be the rednecks of the day, right? They were the farmers. They were the fishermen. They were the roughnecks. They were common people. The New Testament is written in what is called Koine Greek. Koine means common Greek. It was commoners, guys. Common people. And Jesus would utilize common things that they used every day to help explain truth, universal truth to them. And Paul does that here. I think it's interesting. Verse 28. Somebody read verse 28 for us. Acts 17, verse 28. Now, it's interesting here. He brings in here a Greek poet who is probably a pagan, polytheistic. He probably worships Zeus or maybe one of these other gods. And yet he's speaking truth. And it's interesting. Paul takes that and uses it. Somebody that they knew well, it would be like quoting Lady Gaga or something. I don't know. You know, I mean, even a broken clock is right twice a day, isn't it? Okay. And so here you have an instance here where he takes some of the culture and helps people understand it in their own terms. All right? Think about even the way he used the altar to the unknown God to begin with. Man, I see you guys are real religious. I mean, you even got an altar here to a God that you're not even sure exists, but just in case he does exist, you got your bases covered here. He's using the culture here to help them to understand. Guys, for instance, that's one of the reasons why in the church, music has changed over the years. Now, we're still singing about the cross. We're still singing about God and His grace and His mercy and all those things. But it's changed. Why? Because the context has changed around us, okay? No one's doing Gregorian chant anymore, right? I mean, you think about Christian music. I mean, that was the original Christian, when you think about it, when you really go back, okay? Sort of maybe the Gregorian chants or something like that. Then you think about moving on through in the Catholic Church, antipathal singing, or I'm sure Mark will correct me on that, but where basically one side singing and the other side answers back, and they had all this, it's changed. It's changed over the years. Why? Because, as Paul demonstrates here, we're to use common culture to help common people understand the good and awesome grace of God. Third here, our witness should contain, or it should bring to conscience, people's sins. I mean, that's what witnessing is all about, right? We're trying to get them to Jesus, and you can't get somebody to Jesus unless they first understand they're a sinner. And so he says here in verse 29, Acts 17, 29, being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. In other words, he's saying, listen, guys, you can't continue to worship a false god. You're sinning. You shall have no other gods before me, God said. He's bringing to mind, he's bringing to the conscience people's sins. And then finally, our witness should call people to repent and believe on Jesus before God condemns them. Like, man, what a downer. I don't want to tell people that. I just want to tell them about the love of God. You are telling them about the love of God when you tell them that God has sent Christ to save them from their sins. Acts 17, 30 and 31. Look at this here. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent because he's fixed a day on which he'll judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he's appointed. And of this he's given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. He doesn't say his name, but who's he talking about? Jesus. Jesus will one day judge us. And we've been assured of this because Jesus has been raised from the dead. Our witness should, it should contain these things. Now, I'm not saying you have to go by rote, just a checklist, did I say that? But our witness should contain things like this, okay? When we're witnessing to folks and when we're talking. And you've got to find a way to bring it up in everyday conversation, all right? You can't just go into robot mode and now I'm going to begin a gospel, presentation with you today. You weave it in, you talk, you find ways to make it real and to make it genuine, all right? And we should expect three responses. We see three responses here to finish up tonight. The three responses that we see right here in the Areopagus are the responses that you and I will meet every day when we try to be a witness for Jesus. The first one is, you're crazy. Look right here. Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. Hey, you talk about Jesus? You can talk about God all day long. This generic idea of God. But when you bring Jesus into the conversation, it changes everything. You talk about people rising from the dead, and here at Christmas, you start talking about ladies giving birth to babies, and the lady was a virgin. I mean, then you're at a dividing line. People are going to think that you're crazy. You're going to see all sorts of articles here in the next few weeks trying to explain how the virgin birth couldn't have happened. Here's how it probably happened and all this other stuff. People are going to think you're crazy. Are you okay with that? Right? I'd rather be thought well of God or by God than for the society to think that I'm great. Right? So they're going to think you're crazy. The second response that we see here that you and I are going to face is, you might convince me if you continue on. You ever had that with people? You begin to tell them about Jesus, and they don't shut you down. They don't mock you. They don't threaten you. They don't call you names. But they're interested. They're curious. Aren't you excited when you see people like that? Actually, missiologists, they actually have scales for this. And they've got different names for these scales, but they try to rate how open is the person. There are those who are very closed, you're crazy, to those who are like, you know, tomorrow come back and tell me some more about that. You know, I think about, you know, Channon, you're the fellow at Subway you begin to talk with. You want to share just real quickly about that?
Well, actually, there was a young man from India that was working at Subway there behind Mass Auto Parts, and I just greeted him regularly, and he would greet me, and then one day I was in there doing my Bible study fellowship. So guys, if you want to find out more about God's Word, we meet every Tuesday at Living Hope and tell you more about it. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't much business there that morning, and he saw me over there, and he came over, and we talked before. Oh, he had a bad cough, and I happened to have bought a whole package of cough candy, so I brought him in and gave him half the bag to begin with. But then this next day when I was studying my Bible study, he came over and asked me if I would like to teach him English. And I said, sure, but can I use the Bible? And instantly I had an in, but it got difficult because his employer wanted him to be on the clock basically the whole time he was there, that he couldn't take a break.
Sure.
And so eventually he and his wife moved to Atlanta, but before he did, I was able to give him a Bible in his own language, an English Garate dictionary, and testimonials from a Garate Christian church in Pennsylvania. And yeah. So he's got that with him. So
yeah.
I don't know what's happened yet, but I have his phone number.
That's right, yeah. So that's a neat, and we all probably have stories we could tell where people are sort of on the hook. We've got them on the hook. We haven't landed them yet. They've not turned and ran away yet. They're on the hook, and they're on their way to Jesus. They're just not there yet. But guys, if you'll continue to be faithful, if you'll be patient, if you will love them and be patient and show them kindness, but most of all, talk to them about Jesus, and you never know what God will do.
By the way, the guy who took his place, he and his wife, his name is Mike.
Yeah.
And he always, whenever he serves me, he says, thank you, my friend. So
yep.
I address him as my friend.
Great, yeah.
So I'm hoping that I get the same opportunity with Mike.
Absolutely. And then the final response that you will get, and we see it right here, is give me Jesus. And you know what? You never know when that time's going to come. You know, the Bible talks about some sowing, some watering, and others harvesting. You might be that person who's going to harvest, all right? You're the person who's coming along, and you don't have to do any work at all other than say, here's Jesus, and they say, give me Jesus. I got to have Jesus. Look what it says here. But some men, verse 34, but some men joined him and believed on Jesus, among whom also were Dionysius, the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris or Damaris, and others with him. Those are the responses you're going to get. But guys, you know what? When it comes to those results, our results as witnesses, we're not responsible for the results. What is our responsibility? To be a what? A witness. Be a witness. And it's between them and God which response comes. But praise God when that person says, give me Jesus. As we come to the close of the series here, Ignite, here's my final prayer. May God ignite us to be witnesses for Jesus from Bowling Green to the ends of the earth.